Welcome to Pets Tell the Truth. This program is dedicated to understanding our animal companions on a deeper level. I'm Dr. Agnes Thomas, psychologist and animal telepathic communicator. I'll be your host as we listen to what our animal friends are saying, and as we appreciate the way they view the world, their missions, and their incredible spiritual insights. The first part of the show, I will discuss animals as medical helpers with our guest, Leslie Corin Ash. The second part is reserved for listeners to call in with their questions. Please call in about the topic that we are speaking about this evening. The worldwide toll-free number is 877-876-5227. That's 876-5227. Today's show is brought to you by Garnett Publishing in Cleveland, Ohio. Garnett is calling for finished manuscripts, so if you have a manuscript that you would like to share and see in print, contact them at www.garnettpublishing.com. That's with two T's. Or telephone them directly at 216-458-6100. They are the publisher of my book, Pets Tell the Truth. And it is available in bookstores everywhere and also on Amazon.com. Tonight, my friend and fellow animal communicator, Leslie Corin Ash, will be discussing pets as medical helpers. Leslie is a licensed independent clinical social worker with 28 years experience in clinical practice working with people with chronic life-threatening illnesses and disabling conditions. Leslie has worked in hospital settings with rehabilitation and psychiatric programs, and also in home health care with hospice and teams specializing in neurological disorders like ALS. As an animal communicator, Leslie has done a lot of work with whales and other marine life. Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Oh, thank you, Agnes. It's a delight.
Leslie, tell us how you got from clinical work into animal communication. What made you interested in that?
Actually, I would have to say it's the animals themselves, because I wasn't doing this before I started working in hospice. And once I started doing that work, I noticed that the pets of people who were dying seemed to be grieving or seemed to be angry or would defend their person from the visiting nurses. And, you know, we would come in day and night, you know, from the VNA. And it just seemed sometimes like these animals must have studied Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, because they seem to be doing the same grieving that I saw people doing in the households.
Can you give us an example?
I had a patient who was dying of lung cancer. She didn't really have much in the way of family. She didn't have that many friends other than people she knew from work. Her family were her animals. They consisted of three rescued cats and one rescued dog. And one of them was just despondent, didn't move or do anything. One hid under the bed. The dog was angry. And something happened that was just extraordinary. You know, what typically happens when someone is dying is, first of all, they don't want to believe it's true, and they spend a long time kind of not dealing with it, and that's, you know, that's okay. That's how people cope. But she had prided herself on taking in stray animals because as a child, she wasn't given much in the way of loving from her family. Mm-hmm. And she was orphaned at a very young age. And when she could no longer reach up to arrange her hair, which was her pride and joy, short curly hair, and she loved to play with it. But she couldn't. She couldn't lift her arms above her shoulders. So her cat started to get up on the top of the lounger where she sat every day, watched her TV. And the cat would very, very gently let her claws out about just halfway and would arrange her hair for her. It was amazing.
Darling.
And she said, "I don't understand what's going on here. I mean," I asked her about that, and she said, "Well, you know, I haven't been able to do anything with my hair. I can't get my hands up, you know, to comb my hair, do anything." And she started doing it. She never did that before. And I said, "Well, you know, you never needed her to do that before." Well, boy, that opened the floodgate. She started crying and crying for all the things in her childhood she yearned for but didn't get, and all the things about her current condition. And it was kind of like that cat helped her to open the floodgates and deal with her illness,
mm-hmm.
and also gave her a real experience of mothering.
Yes, that she never had.
Yeah, yeah.
And such tenderness.
It was very extraordinary to see this woman who had to learn how to be tough because she was orphaned by the age of 16,
mm-hmm.
to see her melt because of the love
of
the cat
little animal
gave her.
Yeah. Well, see, can you please tell us what ALS stands for? I know I've asked you this several times, but I keep forgetting.
Yeah, everybody else does, too.
I don't know why, but it's like Lou Gehrig's disease, right?
It's, yeah, and the reason it's probably called that is that the actual term is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. What that means is that the muscles waste away. And what the disease does is to gradually paralyze you. And it can start with your legs or it can start with your upper body. And that's probably the worst part. By the upper body, I mean the jaw. So people who get the upper body kind of ALS end up sometimes not being able to speak at all, not being able to eat, so they need to be fed by a tube, and eventually not being able to breathe. And
respiratory muscles are infected, too.
Yeah. So although most people, when they think about a paralysis, they think, well, you know, I would hate to not be able to walk. And as miserable and hard as that can be, not being able to talk is even worse. Then you're really cut off from people.
Or even chew your food.
I'm sorry?
Even chew your food.
Or even chew your food, yeah. Yeah, you need to have
Leslie, tell me what happens to the brain? Is this a peripheral nerve disease, or is this...
No, it's not. It's not related to that. Most people stay alert and clear for the whole of their illness until the end. It's 100% fatal. There are people who've lived with it for a long time, but for the most part, the lifetime expectancy after diagnosis is about 2 to 5 years, although those are averages, and there are many people who live longer than that. But the mind stays very clear, except for a small percentage of people who do get an ALS-like dementia.
What happened during your home visits with animals and humans that changed the course of your clinical investigation? Was there a single incident that really got to you?
Oh, yeah.
Like, was there somebody ready to commit suicide or something?
Yeah. I had a patient who, with ALS, who had to go on a ventilator because he couldn't breathe on his own anymore. So his bedroom looked like a little ICU. He had a ventilator. He had a suction machine. He had a machine for helping air to go in and out. He had a whole array of stuff around the bed. and his wife, who was an RN, had taken a leave to take care of him. He had two kids, a boy, 16, a girl, 13. And this guy had been an incredible athlete as a youngster.
Oh.
And his son, who is now 16, was also an incredible athlete. And this fellow was his son's coach for the son's three varsity teams, football, basketball, and baseball. So it was, they had a very, very close relationship. And the guy himself was in incredibly good shape, I think, because he was acting as a coach, you know, all year long. He had a younger daughter who he doted on, but she was 13 and popular and busy with her friends. And so what started happening is that people, they couldn't talk to him, so they wouldn't go into the bedroom to say hello. And what capped it off was he had a German Shepherd, and after the guy came home with all this machinery around him, the dog got really nervous around the machinery, and he wouldn't come see the guy either.
The dog?
The dog. So, you know, I always ask, you know, family members about family pets and what they've observed, you know. And she said, it's funny you mentioned that because, our dog won't even go in the bedroom. I don't know whether he doesn't like the smell or it's hard to get close to my husband. I don't know, but he won't go near him. And so I said, you know, I might be able to help with that. So I went in, and he understood everything I said, and he couldn't make any sound at all, but he could mouth the word,
mm-hmm.
so he could kind of get it,
mm-hmm.
and his wife would help me to understand. And I asked him that if it was true that everyone had kind of stopped saying hello, including the dog, and he was able to indicate with his eyebrows, yes. And I said, would you like me to help you with that? And he indicated yes again. So I got some training before the next time I met with him in how to help his dog come near him using some treats. But before I did that, before I went back to visit, you know, for my next
uh-huh.
visit, I really thought hard about what was going on with this dog. So when I got together with the couple at that point, I asked the guy, what do you think your dog thinks about you? And he was able to mouth words like, he doesn't care about me. And I said, well, how do you know that? Well, he doesn't visit me.
Yeah.
And I said, well, do you think your dog is, mad? And he said, oh, no, I don't think that. I can tell when he's mad. And I said, do you think your dog worries about you? And he said, well, how would I know? And I asked the dog, and the dog said, well, you know what, I worry about him all the time. But like his wife and kids, I don't want him to see me worry. So when I start to feel sad or worried, I leave the room so he won't see me looking like that. And his wife smiled and said, well, that's when I leave the room, too. I don't want him to see me looking sad either.
Hmm.
And so I asked him, do you think your dog really cares about you? And he thought, no, because, again, he couldn't talk to him.
Uh-huh.
And the dog said, don't be silly. I love you. Of course I care about you. I know you can't talk. I know what you're thinking anyway. I love you no matter what. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to talk to me. I love you. Well, that was like you could see with the little function, muscle function in his face, you could see something relax. And then I did a little bit of behavior stuff with the dog who hadn't come closer to a foot of the guy, and got him to take a treat out of his hand. So the guy was real happy about that.
Oh, the sun must have come up for the guy.
Yeah.
Knowing that the dog still loves him and wants to be with him. And,
oh, yeah, absolutely. But then we had another piece to this. So I said, now, the next time we meet, we have to have your kids here. So we did that in the evening because they both had lots of after-school stuff. And so I asked the kids some of the same kinds of questions, but I asked them, well, do you think your dog is like a family member? And the boy said, oh, yeah. And the girl said, no, he's not like a family member. He's a pest. He bothers me. And I said, well, do you ever bother your older brother? And he's laughing away. And she said, well, like, maybe. And he's laughing. And I'm saying, you mean to say that your dog is a pest to you like you're a pest to your brother?
Uh-huh.
And they're all laughing because it's true. And so I said, do you think that your dog loves your dad? And they said, oh, yeah. And I said, do you think your dog worries about your dad as much as you do? And so, you know, they weren't sure, and they said, well, I don't know. And I said, and I asked the dog, and the dog said, of course I do. Of course I worry. And, you know, he mentioned that he'd leave the room so the guy wouldn't see him when he felt really sad. So I said, here's the next thing. The dog is going to need ongoing help with this because, you know, he needs to get used to the fact that your father's in a wheelchair, that he can't move, he can't talk. So I want a volunteer to help work with the dog. So very, very fortunately, the son volunteered, and I put him through the same little behavioral technique with a dog treat as I had done when I was last there,
mm-hmm.
so that the boy would eventually get to where he would touch his father and put the treat in his father's hand. This is a boy who hadn't touched his father in months, and they had been very close, and they hugged each other all the time. So you could see that the father was thrilled that his son had touched him, even though he couldn't express it fully. And I said, you know, you can't just do this once with a dog. You really have to do this all the time, every day after school when you come home. You have to do this. Well, now, what the kids didn't know is when I first went out there, the wife told me that they were planning to end her husband's life in about a month because he felt he had no quality of life.
What
and
do you mean
she,
they were going to end his life?
So they were going to end his life.
His a suicide?
Yeah, yeah. And she didn't know what else to do because she kind of felt like he really didn't have any quality of life either.
So in other words, they were going to disconnect him from the life
yeah,
support?
Yeah, exactly.
I understand.
And so, yeah, not like, you know, you have to do anything. You just disconnect the tubing.
Like Dr. Kevorkian, right?
Yeah.
None of those.
Actually, no, Dr. Kevorkian generally gave people an injection. So that's
a more active
thing to do. When someone is on a ventilator, what you're doing is actually pulling the plug in that case.
Right.
And they go
right.
into a deep sleep, a coma.
Right.
So they're not experiencing what's called air hunger.
Leslie, have you ever had a case in which you could no longer communicate with the patient and you communicated with the animal to find out how things were going?
Yeah, but I just want to finish the last piece of the story. So the next month went by. The son kept working with the dog. All plans of suicide were shelved. It was never mentioned again. And I talked to the man's wife. He had died a few years after that, but had some really wonderful time with his family. And she said, you know, that did it. After the dog and my son worked with my husband, that was it. There was no more talk of that.
Great.
So I really regarded the dog as saving this man's life.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, I have had patients who could no longer talk, whose pets have been able to communicate to me a little bit of what they think is going on, because, of course, they don't completely know what's going on with their person either. But they have been able to communicate sensations of emotion.
Yes.
And sometimes, in fact, when people are dying, in the last few days, often they're more at peace than their family members.
Oh, yes.
As the dying person approaches death, they become calmer. The family becomes much more panicked. And the pets are kind of tuning in, and they get from the get-go that the person is dying. They seem to get that better than the human members of the household do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will tell me, you know, my person is really at peace with this. And so then I can convey to the people in the household, you know, so-and-so is really feeling very peaceful now and okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants you to know that, and I get that through the cat or the dog or whatever. They are able to communicate to me that, you know, your person is feeling okay about this. So it gives the family who's really suffering horribly at that point a little bit of respite. I mean,
right.
Yeah, I don't think it takes away the anguish that they're going through when you love someone dearly. Nothing probably takes that away, but they get a little moments of peace because of that. And then that animal becomes really important to them, even more than before, because that animal has become a link to the person, to their soul, to their spirit.
Mm-hmm. It's been my experience talking with animals that that are present when somebody dies, because the family will call me about, you know, somebody died in the family or another pet has died. And the animal really does seem to know, is very much connected, and is not distressed. Furthermore, animals can see angels. Animals are surrounded by angels. They can see the angel come to be with that person. They can see an angel come to pick up the body of the animal that has died. And they can see people like grandparents. Now, I can't see any of this, but they can show me what they see. And what they show me is that sometimes, especially around 2:30 in the morning, it seems to be that the veil between this world and the next world is very thin. And a lot of times dogs will start barking in the middle of the night, and the owners don't know what's going on. And they call me and say, why does my dog bark at 2:30 in the morning every night? And it's because I ask them what's happening, and they show me that there is an angel in the room, and usually there is a family member. Now, I don't know who these people are, but I can describe what they look like. And it's usually either a parent of one of the couple, and they're there to tell them how very much they're cherished. And what they're trying to do is make their presence known in a dream to these people. But the dog can actually see them. Very interesting.
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up. When I worked in hospice, I often found that patients themselves experienced just what you're describing, the animals.
Yeah, my brother did when he died, too.
And I once got told by a patient who was within a day or two of death, I was in her bedroom, and I sat down in an easy chair in her bedroom to talk to her, and she said, oh, you can't sit there. My Aunt Sophie is sitting there. She's not living, but she's present as a spirit, and you'll squash her. I got up and moved out.
Guys, it seems very, very real to them.
Oh, it was totally real. And
oh, sure, because you know why? Because at that stage, they're actually seeing into another dimension.
Yeah. Now I believe them. I think they were really experiencing this. And later, I went to a graduate seminar on death and dying and bereavement. And I brought up the issue, and the woman teaching said, well, you know, people hallucinate just before they die. And I said, well, how do you know it's a hallucination? I mean, there's no way to really know. And I don't think we can discount the possibility that it may not be a hallucination.
I've heard that. I've heard some people who are in the medical profession, they say, oh, no, it's a hallucination, and it's because the neurochemistry, this, that, and the other. Well, if it was just that, then how could they know so much detail? And why does the animal see it? And why do other family members see it?
It's a very widespread phenomenon, and it used to be, and what happened to me at that professional meeting is that the woman teaching wouldn't have anything to do with me. Now, this is going back like 15 years. This spring, I went to a seminar on a similar issue taught by a guy who's been in the field for a very long time, and I brought up that issue, and he said, I'm so glad you did, because most people in the medical field are scared to death to bring this up, even though they hear about it from their patients a lot,
okay,
because they're afraid they'll get laughed at. But it's really time for us to start talking about something we know, because we hear it from our patients all the time.
Thank goodness for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote extensively about this, and it has been my experience as well as a psychologist that people like to talk about the experience of dying. They want it, just like a girl wants to tell another girlfriend about what's going on in her life, and she doesn't necessarily want the girl to solve the problem as much as she just wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
And this is things that men don't understand. I mean, if you tell a man a problem, they believe they have to solve it. But a girl doesn't feel that way.
Well,
they want to tell somebody what it's like. I was fortunate to be with my brother, and of course my husband when he died, but my brother was very literate, very well educated, and when he died, I was at his house. He had had a stroke and he was totally paralyzed, and he was telling me what was going on. Finally what took him is he had a cardiac arrest, but he was, even then, it was like a travelogue.
Mm-hmm.
He was telling me that there were people up in the corner of the room, and he was reaching up his one arm, which he had a little motor activity in, and he was reaching up, and he kept saying, I can't get up, pull me up, pull me up. And he was telling the people who were in spirit to help him to get out of his body.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the last things he said to me is, take my pulse. I'm having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and yes, he was having a heart attack. And he says, I'm feeling pain in my chest, I know that my mind is slowing, and I know that I'm going to die now. And he did. But it was like a travelogue, the whole illness. He wanted to tell somebody. It was also very informative.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you that, very honestly, I think that women also struggle with this. I know when I first started in hospice, my own anxiety and fear about being with people who are dying was such that I'd want to solve their problems too. And it took a lot of maturing for me to get to the point of really being a witness to that person's dying process without trying to intervene. I mean, I would certainly do things, you know, to make them more comfortable, whatever
sure.
that might be, but to know that I wasn't going to solve anything, that I could be there, and I could be there to listen to them, not tell them what to do, that that's the most important thing you can do. But
okay.
I found, I have to tell you, it was very, very hard for me to get to that point.
Why? Did it stir up your own fears?
Oh, I'm sure it did. I have no doubt that it did that. That, you know, I mean, I can be a clinician, but I'm still a person, and I'm sure that it stirred up all that stuff for me.
Yeah.
So I had to really struggle with that as a person and as a clinician to give myself the ability to be able to listen patiently and not try to solve anything at all.
No, you don't have to at that point. Many years ago, actually when I was 23, I broke my neck, and I died in the hospital and had to be resuscitated. And I can tell you it was really an interesting experience. I went out of my body, and I saw them hovering over me trying to resuscitate me, and it was an interesting feeling being in a spirit body.
Mm-hmm.
What it felt like was I felt like I was moving through syrup, and I could see the nurses and the doctors hovering and running, but I could also see their spirit superimposed on them, and as they walked, their spirit did not walk at the same time as them, but they lagged behind just a little bit. It was like going through slow motion. But my big impression of that was the feeling and the experience of deep love, and that we actually are all connected. There was no difference between the body of any other person in that room as a spirit and my own. It was truly an experience of oneness. And ever since that time, I've never been afraid of death, and I understand. And when I visit people in the hospital that are elderly, if they're family, I'll walk into the room, and they'll say to me, even if I haven't seen them for a long time, I'm so glad you're here. I have been waiting for you. And they want to tell me. I feel like the angel of death walking in or something, but they want to tell me what they're going through and what their experience is and the things that they're seeing. And it's pure joy.
It's very life-changing. I've talked to a lot of people who've been clinically dead and resuscitated, and, you know, it's not like everybody has the white light experience, but it is definitely a life-changing event.
Yes, it's
for
it
everybody
totally
who's been
changed
through
me.
And
what it does is it makes you altruistic.
Yeah. It just makes you a little deeper. You know, even if you were never a shallow person to begin with, it makes you deeper. It can't help but make you deeper because you kind of have an understanding that's profound and I think almost impossible to describe in words.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly changes you, and it also changes your priorities.
Yeah.
You no longer are interested in articles, you know what I mean? It's not accumulating things. You become so interested in recreating that experience of being surrounded by love.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite awesome. And actually, when I talk to animals, I have that same experience. It's being totally surrounded by love when you talk to an animal. It's really a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen people who were very hard driving.
Yes.
I worked on a unit with young people who had strokes, and the focus with that population isn't just to get them to where they can, you know, wash and dress themselves and walk around,
mm-hmm.
but to get back to the functioning they were at before their stroke when they were doing some, you know, job, very demanding job. And very often those people were very driven in their work, totally committed to it, whatever it was. Didn't matter so much what the work was as what their attitude was about their work.
Right.
And if they were completely committed to it, they could be a long-haul truck driver, they could be an air, you know, traffic controller. It didn't matter. It mattered what they felt about the work. And often they had taken this to the point of really neglecting their families. And
yeah.
It was only after that experience that they would begin to realize, oh, my God, it's my relationships that count.
Right.
All this other stuff is just good, you know. It's a job. I get a paycheck.
Right.
It's good.
It's
so what?
Life. It's just your job.
Yeah.
Even if it's your own business. It's not your job. Very interesting. Leslie, when I first met you, you were deeply involved in communicating with marine life, and I've been very fascinated by that. Can you tell us how that came about?
What I have to do is go back and say that I have loved animals and nature my entire life.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember any second of my life when I didn't. And I have always lived relatively close to the sea, i.e. usually within 10 miles or less, so I can get to the ocean whenever I want to.
You're in Massachusetts?
I'm sorry?
Are you in Massachusetts?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And to me, the ocean is a source of spiritual sustenance. I think it's probably like people of the desert who describe the desert that way.
Yes.
That sea people really need the sea. I once got recruited for a job out, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles from the coast. And I didn't want to leave my friends, but also I realized I can't be away from the ocean because when I am, I feel like I'm drying up. I don't even know if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah.
But I need to have the ocean near me.
Yes.
You know, it's so much
it's
a part,
part
of
the it's part of the sort of the fluid of your life.
Yeah.
And actually your expression, I feel like I'm drying up.
Yeah.
I always have to live near water too. I'm right on Lake Erie, as you know, and there's something about water. I don't know what it is, but it draws me to it. It gives me a serenity that I would not otherwise have.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to communicate with a whale. Can you tell me what that experience, can you describe that experience?
I will try.
Okay.
I've been interested in everything of the sea and on the sea, again, for as long as I can remember. And I went on my first whale watch over 20 years ago. I wasn't communicating with animals yet, but I remember the very first time I ever did this, a fin whale came up to our boat. Now this is like, it looks like a ferry boat. It's about two or three levels. It's about 60 or 70 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a decent sized boat. And the fin whale swam along the boat. It was as long as the boat.
Wow.
So first of all, to think about an animal that is as big as a 65-foot boat that weighs, you know, tons and tons, it's hard to conceive of. But what was happening with that whale was that he was looking at the people on the boat. And we were looking at him, and he was as curious about us as we were about him. And I got this incredible, joyous feeling. It was extraordinary. I felt my spirit lifting. It was so wonderful. I mean, partly, you know, this creature is clearly intelligent. If we wanted to, that whale could have smashed the boat in a second.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't about that at all. It was about the whale was really interested in the people on board. And later, when I became an animal communicator, I thought it would be interesting to try this. I go out on whale watchers a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I began to be able to communicate with the whales. And I guess the story that I found the most extraordinary was I had gone down to Cape Cod, where we often vacation in the summer, and I had set up a plan and had contacted a marine biologist out on the Cape who is the world's expert on northern Atlantic right whales. It's called a right whale because
R-I-T-H-T.
It was considered the right whale to hunt because there are lots of blubber.
Oh, okay.
And so there's now only about 350 left in the world, and they're hugely endangered. And they keep getting caught in our long lines of fishing. You know, off the coast of New England is one of the biggest fishing grounds in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got all these boats out there kind of playing out what they call long lines, which are fishing nets that are miles long. And so whales get caught in those nets because the weight of something that's miles long is too much.
Mm-hmm.
And if it gets caught the wrong way, the whale can't get out of it. And they panic. So I had tried to reach this guy, and he said, gee, I'd like to talk to you, but I can't because we've got this whale that's been entangled, that's the word for it, and we're trying to rescue it. We don't know where it is. So every day of that week, I talked to that whale, and she said she was a she,
mm-hmm.
and that she had part of the end of the fishing net was crossing her face, so that it, if you could visualize the face, it would start from the forehead above the left eye and cut diagonally across the right eye,
yes.
and down and around the back, and she was just surrounded by netting, and it was weighing her down. So she couldn't come to the surface and breathe. And, of course, whales are mammals. They're air breathers.
That's right.
And they can't stay down forever like fish do. So she was getting very tired, and she was sending me these images of feeling this tremendous pain in her right eye and this tremendous sense of heat and wanting to swim north, because a lot of the right whales go up to the Bay of Fundy during the summer to feed. And so she was trying to head north, but the weight of the fishing net was so great that she couldn't really make much in the way of progress, but the pain was getting worse. And so she would send me colors. Almost, you know, from the beginning, there were beautiful, vivid blue-green colors, and each day the intensity of that color would fade. And by Friday, it had really failed. So, but my best friend was also down there. We often go down vacation at the same time. And she was saying to me, you know, you should tell this guy, you know, about what you're getting. And I said, oh, he'll think I'm nuts. And she said, well, so what? I mean, if you're getting something, tell him. So I called him up, and I said, look, I am an animal communicator, and I've been getting this stuff from this whale that you're trying to find. And he said, geez, why didn't you tell me this at the beginning of the week? And, of course, I wasn't expecting that.
Uh-huh.
I was expecting him to say, oh, you're one of those.
Uh-huh.
See you later, you know. But no, he was really sorry. I hadn't told him from the beginning. So I went to see him, and he said, "Look, you know, I am fine with your communicating with the animals, and if you can send me by postcard, you know, information you're getting, and then we can verify it, then we have a time date, because the post office has stamped it, so we can prove that you got the right information."
Did he try to release her?
That's actually quite dangerous, because whales are running out of air, they're panicked, they thrash around, and
it's still wild.
They go out little rubber zodiacs, it's like a little rubber raft. You know, so they're right on the water level with this huge animal that could easily kill them with just a flick of its flipper.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. Amazingly, they know that you're trying to rescue them, and even though they get agitated, they really try as hard as they can not to hurt the people. But at any rate, I felt the very last day of the whale's life, I felt the experience of her putting her flippers on my cheeks very gently and saying goodbye and saying thank you for being with me.
Oh.
And it was a very, very powerful moment. And I told, you know, this guy Stormy what I got, and he said, "Well, I think you're right. I think if a whale's been entangled this long, generally they're not going to make it." And I said, "I know she's swimming north, and I know it's female." And he said, "Well, all those things actually do make sense from what we know of the rare but occasional sightings. But the reason why it's important for us to be able to verify this is if I know that you're accurate, we can get a Coast Guard cutter. And we can't just do it on a whim. It costs $100,000 to start the engines on a cutter."
Oh.
So you can't just say, "Oh, let's go out," you know.
Yeah,
you can't tie up the Coast Guard that way. They have a job to do. Mm-hmm. They will try to help you if they can, and they're not otherwise engaged. But you can't just willy-nilly take out a cutter. So I got home. A few weeks later, I went on a whale watch, and I ran. And I was telling the biologist on board about all this, and he said, "Oh, wait here. And he got the volunteer, and he said, "I want you to tell the volunteer what you just told me." And I said, "Okay." And I told her, and she said, "Well, what I saw," and she was the person who originally spotted, who notified the Coast Guard and all. She said, "What I saw was the edge of the net was around the whale so that you could see it was across the face. It started from the upper left forehead and crossed right across the right eye diagonally."
Exactly what you saw.
And so, you know, it was the first time I'd gotten a verification from an eyewitness that what I'd gotten was right.
Leslie? Sometimes whales beach themselves. Why do they do that? And why are they now swimming upstream? Whales are saltwater animals, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so why are they now swimming upstream, like in California and also on the East Coast? And why would they beach themselves? Are there more vicious marine life that are after them? Why would they do that?
Well, let me try to take the first question about
why they beach themselves.
There are some theories. I think that there is more of a sense now that some of what's happening is that they can get a virus that disorients them, like an inner ear infection.
Oh.
So they can't steer. Naval experiments with sonar can throw them off because they use a lot of echolocation in navigation. So if it throws off their own locating
apparatus,
physiology,
sure.
And then the third thing is, whales generally travel in pods, not alone, and they function as very close families. And if a whale who's in a pod, especially a matriarch, but doesn't have to be, gets very sick and ends up beaching, you know, they're going there to die. They're not going there in order to take a break. The whales who are healthy in that pod have told me that they don't want to go on living if their mates are dying. And they recognize that there are many people on the beaches who are trying very hard to rescue them, to get them out back into the water again, to keep them wet, and they appreciate the love. They certainly get the love, but it's not necessarily what they want. If they're going to die, they want to die together as a family. They don't want to go on alone. And about the swimming upstream, you remember, you know, all those stories from the tsunami and...
Yes, and about the animals, how they saved themselves.
Right. The animals somehow knew that that something was happening and they needed to get away from the shore. Well, sea animals, just like land animals, have some sensory abilities that humans don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is their ability to use sensitivity to magnetic energies.
Uh-huh.
They think that one way that birds who migrate, you know, 20, 30,000 miles,
uh-huh,
are in some ways homing in on polar magnetic sources.
Sort of a grid, right.
Yeah.
And they can find their way home by following that grid.
Exactly. I mean, they don't really know this. It's a theory, but it seems to make some sense, although I can't say that anyone has proven that beyond a doubt. But what's been happening is that when there is a disturbance under the sea, remember, whales can communicate with each other at subsonic frequencies that humans can't hear, you know, thousands of miles across the ocean. So they must then have the reception equipment to pick up vibrations at a level that we humans just don't have. And so it may be as simple as they are picking up vibrations under the sea of
earth changes.
Yeah, of
like
the earth.
Earthquake or... There must have been a lot of vibration before.
Well, in fact, if you talk to people
on
some of the websites, you know, the geology and and websites about earthquakes, et cetera, ever since that earthquake, which was something like 9.7 on the Richter scale, it's the second most powerful earthquake ever measured.
But the earth
has been
from it.
Wobbling on its axis. It has not stabilized since that event. And so if that's happening, then whales are almost certainly sensing vibration of some kind that may be interfering with the magnetic field.
Right.
I don't know, you know. But it's clear, and it's been observed for hundreds of years, that when whales swim upriver, that they're getting away from some disturbance.
Some geophysical disturbance?
Yeah, in the earth. And they try to get away from whatever it is that they sense as being a disturbance that's not safe.
I see.
So, I mean, I could surmise, but, I'm not a geologist. I don't know.
No, well, we would just speculate.
Yeah, I'm guessing that was such a powerful earthquake that it would certainly have upset the balance of things.
Yes.
But
I have to take a commercial break here. I want the listeners to be reminded to listen to BBS Radio on Thursday evening at 7 p.m. for Metaphysical Straight Talk with my friend Atira Hatton. Atira is a gifted psychic who can tune into your heart's mission in this life. Atira is associated with Edgar Cayce's Association for Research and Enlightenment and is a sought-after speaker on spirituality and metaphysics. If you would like to make an appointment for a phone consultation with Leslie, Leslie, give us your email address.
It's all one word. L is capitalized and the rest is lowercase. LCORINASH@RCN.com.
Okay, and if you would like to make a personal consultation, a phone consultation with me about your pet, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at talktopets@AOL.com. If there's a particular topic you would like to hear about animals, please email me at talktopets@AOL.com, or you can visit my website at www.petstellthetruth.com. If you like the show, you can contact the producers at bbsradio.com and let them know that you would like to hear more of this kind of programming. Leslie, I want to thank you so much for being our guest tonight.
I'm really honored.
And also being very spiritual. I really did not know that much about marine life because I haven't had any experience. And I've had, you know, I've watched the animals at SeaWorld, but we never got close to the whales. They won't let you close. And the only whale that was there was Shamu. And it was a performing whale, so nobody ever got close enough to actually talk to it. But this was very, very fascinating. And I loved hearing about our beautiful marine animals. This is such a change. And from the usual domesticated dog and cat, I have talked to fish, and they are very sweet little creatures. I mean goldfish.
Hello?
And tropical fish.
Everybody there?
People have as pets in their home.
Anybody there?
Well, I want to thank you again. We're listening. This is Dr. Agnes Thomas saying good night. And join us next week. And next week we're going to have a guest who will talk us about animals and numerology.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.